the theme for the afternoon talk is a reflection on happiness. The other day I asked how many of you had been to India. I can't remember what the percentage was, but probably half of you. And if I may say, I've been going there very regularly. And the first time that I went was in 1967. In fact, I was hitchhiking and on my way to here to Israel, and then was going to go from Israel through the Arab countries and on to India. But then in June of 1967, I was rather discouraged from coming, and was hanging out with other hippies on the island of Crete in Greece, in some old Roman caves by the beach, and very happily smoking dope morning, noon and night. And so from there I continued the journey, but instead went through Turkey and Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan and into India. And my memory and recollections of the Middle East and of Arab countries is full of fondness and appreciation and gratitude for the delightful hospitality that I received through these countries. And in India, when I arrived, I became very interested in, more and more interested in the Dharma in a whole variety of ways, and particularly the long-standing Indian traditions of great spiritual exploration. And to its credit, it's still very much alive and well in that respect. And the some of the traditions are of course connected with the Buddhist tradition, which has a long and vibrant life of 2,500 years. And there's the tradition as well, which many of you know well of, and some of you are closely connected with, the tradition of yoga. And yoga, that true sense of it, of being joined, yoked to the truth of things. And one feature of that, of course, is the forms of the body, being really deeply connected with the body, understanding it well, but also the yoga of the heart and mind, the yoga of closeness to the nature, the great yoga of lifestyle as well. And it is a great pity that quite often in the current and common conception of things, yoga is thought of as a series of postures, and you're a great yogi if you can kind of wrap your legs around the back of your neck or something. And rather than seeing it as a great field of spiritual life and essentially a great way of life, which is what the great yogis remind us of. And it's unfortunate, it's been compartmentalized. And this compartmentalizing is a great problem for human beings. There's a great tradition others of you here will be familiar with, and that is of Vedanta, and particularly Advaita Vedanta. Vedas are the original early texts of the Indian tradition, and very much around rituals, ceremonies, mantras, religious forms and practices and celebrations. And anta means the end of, the fulfillment of. And these are the great texts of the yogis, those who had great depths of spiritual experiences, mystical contemplations, and they take the form of the Upanishads and the Brahma Sutras and the Bhagavad Gita, which I referred to the other evening. And in that one finds a great wealth of profound exploration of the human condition, and beautiful texts there. And out of that emerged, in all of this, a exploration again of what is called Advaita, non-duality. To really look into the nature of things, so that this fragmented mind and view of things which again keeps compartmentalizing, and I'll come to this a little bit more in a few moments, which keeps compartmentalizing, it is to break free of that, to have a genuinely liberated way of seeing. And it's extraordinary, the flow of the history, in a very general way for a moment or two. Sometimes a view, it sticks, and very easily the sticking of the view in history, in a reflection of history, passes through from one generation to another, and it's taken as to be the way things are, or the way things were. I give you a couple of examples, because this is going to relate to the talk here. One is, this is not a history lesson, but it's leaning that way, I confess, is that in the tradition, the first great monasteries that were set up in this world were set up in India, and the great monastery and the great university that was set up was the University of Nalanda in the state of Bihar. Hundreds, thousands of monks and meditators and contemplatives there, who, through their experiences and through their dialogues and engagements, like you and I are engaged in here, generated a wealth of reflection on the processes that are going on with the life. And the view arose, this is the view that arose, there's no truth in it, but the view arose, that in the 7th century, a great teacher of Advaita, of non-duality, named Shankara, he then came, and the potency of his realizations and his insights and his commentaries on the old Upanishad texts and the Brahma sutras and the Bhagavad Gita then demolished the Buddhist tradition. No, not a word of truth in it. But the idea, the view got set in, and the tradition lasted at Nalanda University for another 500 years. In a very healthy state, but it wasn't until the invasion of the Mughals, you know, and from the western part of Asia, and those invasions which just demolished the tradition. And this, there, I use it as one small example, and the other, that in the Advaita tradition, for centuries upon centuries, and some of you here have been to India, you've been to satsangs. You know, do people know what satsang is here? It's hard how to say it. Satsang is going to listen to a teacher, which a dialogue takes place, and it's the word most used in the non-dual tradition. And great emphasis is placed on the dialogue. Very beautiful. Like we have, there's a kind of satsang in the inquiry period there. And the function and the purpose of the satsang is to come to some immediacy of some insight and realization. This is the great purpose of satsang. And a view arose, it's another example here, a view arose that there is nothing you can do, any kind of practice requires effort, and any effort is some movement of the ego. I want to get realized. So meditation, reflection, or service, or devotion is the self wanting something. And therefore it's a movement of the ego. This is the view. It's a movement in the field of time. So how can one, exploring things in the field of time, come to the great realization, which is timeless? The view. And the view then got settled in, following on from Shankara, who I have great love and great respect for. Following on from Shankara, that the world is Maya, not named after somebody in Israel. The world is Maya. The world is an illusion, and only Brahman is the only truth, or reality is the only truth, and this world is all Maya. It's an illusion. It's false. It's a deception. And this view became to be put out in the satsang. The world is an illusion. The consequence of this view The Advaita tradition, which is profound and beautiful and I love very, very much, virtually died in India for nearly 1,000 years. Because it didn't respond, I would say, my view here, didn't respond, it didn't relate to people living in the world and say, well, actually, I don't think my life is an illusion. I don't think the world I live in is an illusion there. And I think there is some genuine, relative, conventional, ordinary reality which is going on. And it wasn't until, I say, nearly 1,000 years later, with Ramana Maharshi, and some of you may have been to Tiruvannamalai, who's the great saint of India of the last century, who died in 1950, began giving beautiful teachings on the non-dual, on true reality, through a very core question: who am I? Very core question of human existence: who am I? And how easily, as he pointed out again and again, we get lost in our identity. We imagine, who I am are my thoughts. And no matter what that odd philosopher, what was that Western, I think, therefore I am.
Descartes.
Mr. Descartes had clearly never sat on the meditation cushion. Because he came to the conclusion, I think, therefore I am. And some of us will wonder, I think, therefore I am what? I think, therefore I am? Question mark. Yeah. Which I think is maybe, hopefully, is the deeper communication in the statement of Descartes. Later, sir. Next lifetime. Find me later. Only use it. I might be a little hard on Mr. Descartes, you know, forgive me, etc. Still wishing to make the point. The point is that the view, this, because it stops happiness, this is what I'm coming to. The view itself sounds reasonable, the effect of which, though it may not be intended, becomes the view that we identify with. It becomes the view. I think, and we love thinking, you know, the Western culture is a thinking machine there. I think, that means I am. I can think. And therefore the self in the moment, the I, the me in the moment, has landed in the thought. It's landed in the stream of thoughts. As one person said, landed today, landed in the highway of thinking, landed in the traffic of thinking. And I gave him as a common reminder, all this blocks happiness, remember? A reminder today. You may remember in the old days of the Politburo and the in communism there, and some of you are from Russia, you will know. And on May Day, the 1st of May, they had the big parade. And Mr. Khrushchev, I remember, from way back, and Mr. Brezhnev and these other funny wallets, would be standing there on the big platform, like this. Do you remember, you see, with those little trilby hat on. And he'd be standing there, and in front, the rockets would be going by on the highway, and the big parade, and the soldiers, and the tanks, and all the, what a great nation we are. This is, you know, it's a great ego trip. So they're standing there, and it's just watching it all go by. And that's our meditation. We are Mr. Khrushchev. We just stand there, and all this stuff is going by. And sometimes it just jams up in the middle, you know, you know, it's flowing by and it all crashes in the middle. There's a huge jam and there's a complete chaos inside. You know, you see that. And I was always hoping that would happen in front of Mr. Khrushchev. And, a huge tank would run out of petrol, you know. And then, you know, however, you know what I mean. All right. So this, we live in this, and we easily carry the kind of view. We hold to the view. So the view that, you know, Mr. Shankara ended the Buddhist tradition. It's not true. Other factors did. Or the view that the world is an illusion there. What about some of the views that we hold to here? One of the most popular views, it's a very contemporary one, it blocks happiness. And the view is to turn to the past, look at the past, and make an extraordinary leap in belief. You know, it's a bigger leap than believing Jesus walked on water. And the belief is, my parents were like this, and therefore I am like this. And they are the cause of how I am today. And this leap is a leap too far. And what happens with this leap is that the view blocks the happiness. The view blocks the happiness. And we can't see that. We are convinced that the cause blocks the happiness. The mother blocks the happiness. The father blocks the happiness. And what we have done, because we're in a consumer culture, we have converted love and happiness into a product. And we say, my mother or my father, they had this product called happiness or love, or they didn't have, or they had a little bit, and they only gave a little bit of it to me. And because I didn't get enough, so I can't give any. I can't give this product called love and happiness to anybody else because I didn't get enough. There, it's the same relationship we have with money. We've made love and happiness the same relationship to money. And so the mind, the self, arises and it says, I am like this, therefore I am an effect. This is the effect, I am like this. They, those dreadful two people in the whole world, they, or one, whoever, are like this. And in its movement, in the field of time through me, I've ended up like this. And the measurement is going on is, I didn't get enough. I didn't have enough. Like we have with money, I don't get enough. I wish I had more. And as long as that view is held sacred, as long as that we hold to the view and we keep repeating it to ourselves, is as long as we'll be unhappy. How is it, one might ask? Some people have a pretty distressing and difficult upbringing, maybe have been quite distant from their parents, may hardly even known their parents, may not even had any parents, may have been brought up in all sorts of circumstances, and emerge as loving, happy, sharing, giving human beings. Because if it's a truth and not a view, if it's a truth, parents measure out a certain amount of love, I receive as a human being a certain amount of love. If that's true, then it must be true in all cases. So we should have now been able to measure what the percentage is to help get us through life happily. And why is it that some people who seem to have a very nice upbringing, mummy and daddy put them to sleep every night and read them lovely stories and took them to the best schools and gave them loads of love and took them to McDonald's every other night or whatever they wanted, got all this attention, and grow up as miserable as sin, can't live in this world, can't handle any criticism, fall apart when a relationship changes, and yet it would appear from the history had tons of love poured into them. It seems to me the view, absence, makes me who I am needs to be looked at. I wonder if happiness and love, the same quality, is really totally dependent on the past. I wonder if it is about the past. I wonder if this view is more problematic than we realize. I wonder if we're trying to, as I said earlier, explain something in such a way which actually often doesn't seem to help us. We can have the view, we can believe in it strongly, we can bore each other to death telling each other about our parents or our upbringing or whatever, go on and on about it there, and through that view we don't get any happier. We keep repeating the view, we get more and more unhappy, and we keep saying, oh, it's nothing to do with my view, it's them, those two. And then the parents can say, well, don't look at me because I had parents as well and I'm just a product of them. Well, the grandparents can say, well, hey, come on. All right then, Adam and Eve, I knew that. Where did Adam and Eve come from? Oh, the monkeys. There's always, where do we stop? Where do we stop? Such a phenomena it is, we have this view. But it's going through the culture. It's widely accepted. There's an unquestioning obedience to it. I'm not sure whether love and happiness and the past are totally related. We could easily make a shift and look in a fresh way. And sometimes we have to be rather creative in fresh ways of looking. Not just identify with what the psychologists tell us or what the therapists tell us or what we actually think or imagine. We have to be rather creative to get ourselves out of a difficulty. And just now, going back to India for a moment, Radha, she's an Australian Dharma teacher and great non-dual teacher and a very dear friend of mine. She's known me since I was a monk in India when I first began to give some teachings, and actually gave her the name Radha. And she told a story. This is a nice story of creative imagination to help a difficult situation. It's a true story of two people, I think it was last year or the year before, who went off to Africa and sub-Sahara Africa to visit one of these very large game reserves. You know, we have all the animals there, and it's a very precious and beautiful thing that in Africa and in other parts of the world, you know, there's a growing recognition and growing care and sensitivity to that, basically acknowledging that Buddhist statement of the last 2,500 years to save all sentient beings, you know, to respect all sentient beings. So they had been to Africa several times and went out with a guide in the jeep. And they would visit the lions and the elephants and the panthers and all these creatures there. Well, you know, awesome to see them in their natural habitat. Very, very beautiful. And as they'd been for a number of times, they thought, well, we know the road and we know the tracks and we know where to go. We'll go without the guide. And the two of them, you know, husband and wife, set off. There, and, you know, these game reserves, you know, you know, it's not, you know, Israel is like a little 5% of them. These are huge areas, the size of parts of Europe, huge places. So they went off for the day, and they said, we'll go out for the day, and we'll come back, and they'd driven off, they went off on a new track there and Adam met with us and have a lovely, lovely day. And of course, guess what happened? Right out there, 150 kilometers from the base, and the vehicle broke down. Obviously a British Jeep. Land Rover. Has to be a Land Rover. And they're stuck in the afternoon with a broken down vehicle, no food, a bit of water, and packs of lions wandering around, and nobody knows where they are. Now, you have some sensations to watch, you know, when you're in that kind of environment. What are they going to do? Nobody knows where they are. What are they taking a different road, different turning there? And then they got this quite remarkable idea, because they couldn't walk back, because it was approximately 3 days and nights of walking to get back from the middle of nowhere. They had a tent. This is extraordinary. They had a tent. And they got inside the tent. And with it over the top of the two of them. So the tent was hanging down to their feet. You see, it's just this plastic tent. And with the plastic tent over the top of them, they started 3 days and three nights walking back to the base. And the lions would come round. And they through the tent they could see the lions wandering around, circles around them. These two people in their 40s or 50s they were. And they just kept on walking, 3 days and three nights. It's like this I call creative imagination. So if you go to a game reserve, take your tent. Oh, the human being, what a species we are. Yeah. So sometimes in the circumstances in which we are in, we keep going back to the old habit, the old way, the old interpretation, the old view. And we forget so easily that the view we're bringing is the same view we had last week, last month, last year, and we hold to the view. And in the holding to the view, the measurement comes in. The amount of who I am, the amount of love that I have, the amount of love I don't have, the amount of happiness that I have or I don't have, and the measurement will invite the reasons. The measurement will invite the reasons. And then we're measuring what I lack or what I haven't got or what I'm not, whatever, and the reasons go with it, and put the measurement and the reasons together, and the self then has a position which it identifies with, and there's no happiness. Nor is there love. And it's hard for us to say, wow, the view is fixing where I am. The view is fixing myself as I am. And I'll need the memory. I'll need an interpretation from the past to keep the conviction. And then I'll keep reinforcing it. I'll keep getting others to agree with me. I'll keep getting the authority figures to agree with me. Sometimes we tell each other something which inhibits the love and the happiness. And then the response, which is not the response of a friend, and the response says, oh, I know just how you feel. If I was in your position, I would be angry too. This is no friend. This is somebody who is feeding the problem. The very anger which arises is the problem. It is the block to the happiness and to the love. So if we're to make some change, if we're to look in a fresh and creative way, maybe we need new parents. maybe those two lovable sentient beings who may still be in this world or not in this world, those two lovable sentient, maybe we have an idea that they are our parents. Maybe it's a rather small view. Maybe we are sons and daughters of the earth. Maybe our parent is nature. Maybe we are coming from Mother Nature. Now what's the response inside? We're forgetting those two little sentient beings who got together one night and a little bit of sea travelled across from one to the other and boom, here we are. It's a tiny little event in the universe, in Mother Nature. You say, let me take the emphasis off that. And let me switch the emphasis to what the Greek gods referred to as Gaia, to Mother Earth, to the living Earth. Maybe our mother and father is here in every day. And just sometimes, just switching the emphasis to that. Wow. Does every day life come and touch me? Does every day, through my eyes, my ears, my nose, my tongue, and my touch, am I being nourished every day? Is Mother Earth supporting me every day? Is Mother Earth available and present in my life every day? Yes, 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 yes. Whoa, whoa. Could it be, regardless of the history, regardless of the past, which has no existence except for my view, could it be that this day, and what emerges this day, with conscious life, can bring an inexhaustible amount of love out of us? Because I've got no view about those two little sentient beings that were wandering around, or still are. I'm not holding them responsible or accountable. I find Mother Earth is here. Mother Nature is here. The Father of all things is here. The foundation of all things is here. Abba is here. And I can be inspired by that and draw from that, and the confirmation of Mother and Father is here through eyes, ears, nose, tongue and touch. And that sense for that, and that appreciation for that, and the recognition of that, that we are sons and daughters of the earth, that the emergence out of that will bring out of that realization tremendous love and tremendous happiness. Wow. My mother and father have never abandoned me for a moment. My mother and father have never been separate from me for a single split second. I'm in their embrace every day. I can see it with my senses. I can see it. I can see it in my language of Abba, of Mother, Mother Earth. And the sense of that takes the pressure off yesterday and yesteryear and what was, and it places us firmly, intimately, closely with things are. And then the sense of family is with it. And the religions and the ideas and the beliefs and the identities and all those things that you and I touch upon, they begin to drop away, and it's much more simple. We're human beings that have emerged out of the womb of life. That we're all brothers and sisters in this all together. And it's one human family participating in the great embrace of life. And that sense will bring the happiness. And that recognition of the bare truth of it will bring the love and bring the joy. And one's committed to truly knowing what it is to be at home. Not some little flea pit that we live in somewhere or other around. And sometimes, you know, the boxes that we live in, you know, I've just been talking about like the family box that we live in, this little constriction that we have with name and bloodline or whatever it might be, a terribly small box to live in, you know, or the home. And then people say, oh, I've got a nice flat, got a nice apartment, but I need a bigger place, I need a better place, a nicer suburb or a bigger house. It's easy to get a bigger place. Just get rid of all the stuff that you've got in your own place and you'll have a lot more space in there, and that's all you need. Just clear it out, give it to those who have little. And so we get these ideas, and the ideas put us in the box. And if one says, I don't want a boxed life. There. So we pay respect to our home, we pay respect to our family, we're content if we're living in one room, and we're content if we're living in, have several rooms, we're content if we have a garden, if we're content if we don't have a garden, because we're in the garden of life. And we engage in the practicalities, you know, we have to earn some money, and we have our friends, and we give our love to our biological parents, or whatever it might be. All of that, take that responsibility. We're not living in a dream world, but we're not clinging to views and opinions which are not liberating. We just refuse to hold on to views and opinions in life which are not liberating. We're not going to tie ourselves down to it, no matter who the authorities are. And therefore we use our creative imagination. We have a different sense of things. And so some of those primary concepts I'm today calling mother and father, there are many of them today, mother and father. We can have a different relationship, a different discovery of who my true parents are. Born out of the nature, emerging out of the nature, belonging to the nature, sons and daughters of the nature. And if that sense starts to come through, happiness will come through with it. The love will come through to it. Through. If it's realized. If it's just an idea, it will make a scrap of difference to our life, and we'll just go back to the miserable old habits of thinking all the blame and responsibility lies with those parents, and they can equally say, don't put the blame on us, put it on our parents. And we go back and back and back. Boring. Everybody's got somebody else to take the responsibility. Everybody. We have to break out of that. And then realize it well and clearly, just enough, not perfectly, just enough, so that you and I live a life which is authentic. No transcendent view of trying to get beyond everything. Not at all. If there's any direction, it's not getting away from, it's actually being intimately close with. If any direction to go in life, it's closer to life. Not a pulling away from it. And in that closeness to life, we can't carry the past as a weight, no matter what it is. Can't carry the past. It will be a weight upon us. We can just carry the love and the intimacy for the present. It's a great challenge for us. May all beings live with love. May all beings live with happiness. May all beings realize our true home. couple of quiet minutes.